and welcome to Azo Nano News for the week commencing the 25th of February 2008, brought to you by azonano.com. My name is Stuart Cameron. In this edition of Azo Nano News, as well as bringing you the latest news from the international nanotechnology industry, we'll hear how a new type of LED is helping to make LCDs even more effective. We'll hear about a new discovery that sheds light on the electronic structure of DNA, and we'll also hear about a new type of vaccine that will get up your nose quite literally. In this week's interview, Azo Nano's Cameron Chai speaks to Andrew Maynard, the Chief Science Advisor for the Project on Emerging Nanotechnologies at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. These stories and many more in this edition of Azo Nano News. In recent years, light-emitting diodes, or LEDs, have begun to change the way we see the world. Now, a Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute student has developed a new type of LED that could allow for their widespread use as light sources for liquid crystal displays, or LCDs, on everything from televisions and computers to cell phones and cameras. Martin Schuber, a doctoral student in electrical, computer and systems engineering, has developed the first polarized LED, an innovation that could vastly improve LCD screens, conserve energy and usher in the next generation of ultra-efficient LEDs. Schuber's polarized LED advances current LED technology in its ability to better control the direction and polarization of the light being emitted. With better control over the light, less energy is wasted, producing scattered light, allowing more light to reach its desired location. Utilizing a technique that combines low temperature measurements and theoretical calculations, Hebrew University of Jerusalem scientists and others have revealed for the first time the electronic structure of single DNA molecules. The knowledge of the electronic properties of DNA is an important issue in many scientific areas, from biochemistry to nanotechnology. For example, in the study of DNA damage by ultraviolet radiation that may cause the generation of free radicals and genetic mutations. In those cases, DNA repair occurs spontaneously via an electronic charge transfer along the DNA helix that restores the damaged molecular bonds. In nanobioelectronics, which is the advanced research field devoted to the study of biological molecules to produce electronic nanocircuits, for example, it's been suggested that DNA or its derivatives may become used as possible conducting molecular wires in the realization of molecular computing networks, which are smaller and more efficient than those produced today with silicon technology. An international team has created a controlled chemical process that causes intrinsically non-magnetic atoms of gold, silver, and copper to become magnetic. According to the research, in which researchers from the UPV EHU, as well as teams from Australia and Japan, have taken part, the magnetism appears to reduce the dimensions of the material to nanometric dimensions and surround it with previously selected organic molecules. The magnetism of these nanoparticles is permanent, like iron, which, even at ambient temperatures, is quite significant. This discovery goes beyond the mere fact of converting non-magnetic elements to magnetic ones. These properties appear in smaller-sized particles that have never been seen in classical magnetic elements. In fact, they can be considered as the smallest magnets ever obtained. Moreover, such properties do not occur only at low temperatures, but they are conserved, apparently without any degradation, at temperatures well above the ambient ones. Researchers at the UCLA Henry Samuel School of Engineering and Applied Science, with the use of molecular dynamics simulations, have solved a decade-old mystery that could one day lead to commercially practical designs of storage materials for use in hydrogen gas-fueled vehicles. In 1997, it was discovered that adding a small amount of titanium to a well-known metal hydride, sodium alginate, not only lowers the temperature of the hydrogen release from the material, but also allows for an easy refueling and storage of high-density hydrogen at reasonable pressures and temperatures. In fact, the weight percent of stored hydrogen was instantly doubled in comparison with other inexpensive materials. With computers and the power of basic physics, chemistry and quantum mechanics, the group decided to take a step back and analyze the sodium alginate in its pure form without added titanium. The group analysed the atomic processes occurring in the material and what happens to the chemical bond between the hydrogen and the material at the temperatures of hydrogen release. The computation gave the researchers information that would have been very difficult to obtain experimentally. They hope their findings will one day facilitate the design and creation of an affordable and environmentally friendly hydrogen vehicle. For the first time, researchers at North Carolina State University have demonstrated that microscopic two-faced spheres, whose halves are physically or chemically different, so-called Janus particles, will move like stealthy submarines when an alternating electric field is applied to liquid surrounding the particles. A paper describing the research, published in the February 8, 2008 edition of Physical Review Letters, advances knowledge about how potential smart materials, think of tiny engines or sensors, can move around and respond to changes in their environment. Janus particles could be used as microscopic mixers, molecular shuttles, self-propelling microsensors, or means of targeted drug delivery. When plant cells divide, they assemble molecular building blocks into new cell walls made of carbohydrate and protein. But scientists know almost nothing about how this process occurs. A team of researchers at the University of Massachusetts Amherst has found that the first step in building new plant cell walls is the assembly of a scaffold made of structural proteins, a process similar to using metal or wood scaffolding to construct the walls of a building. Unlocking the secrets of how plants build cell walls could lead to better materials for the production of biofuels such as ethanol from cellulose, plant fibers that are cheaper and more plentiful alternatives to the starches currently used. Plant cell walls are the most abundant biomass on Earth. If we know how the cell wall assembles, we can exploit this information to engineer plants with cell wall structures and compositions that are commercially desirable. The kilogram is apparently losing weight. And many international scientists, including some at Sandia National Laboratories, agree that it's time to redefine it. Scientists are hoping to redefine the kilogram by basing it on standards of universal constants rather than on artifact standards. The International Prototype Kilogram, or IPK, or Le Grand K, made in the 1880s, is a bar of platinum-iridium alloy kept in a vault near Paris. Of the 7 units of measurement in the International System, or SI, the kilogram is the only base still defined by a physical object. In addition, copies of the kilogram have changed over time by either gaining or losing weight as compared to the standard kilogram. The purpose of redefining the kilogram is based on risk reduction. Indiana University Bloomington chemists have designed an organic molecule that binds negatively charged ions, a feat they hope will lead to the development of a whole new molecular toolbox for biologists, chemists, and medical researchers who want to remove chlorine, fluorine, and other negatively charged ions from their solutions. Chelating agents are small molecules that grab atoms, or sometimes even smaller molecules, out of a solution and hold onto them. Chelators play a valuable role in both nature and laboratory settings. For example, the human protein calmodulin not only grabs positively charged calcium ions out of the solution surrounding it, it also influences cell processes according to how many calcium ions it's grabbed. Most organic molecules exist that can bind positively charged ions, or cations, and this has much to do with the fact that it's easy to synthesize organic molecules with negatively charged parts. It's those negatively charged parts that interact with positive ions or cations, grabbing them out of the solution and holding onto them so the cations cannot react or interfere with other processes. A novel technique for vaccinating against a variety of infectious diseases using an oil-based emulsion placed in the nose rather than needles has proved able to produce a strong immune response against smallpox and HIV in 2 new studies. The results build on previous success in animal studies with a nasal nanoemulsion vaccine for influenza, reported by University of Michigan researchers in 2003. Nanoemulsion vaccines developed at the Michigan Nanotechnology Institute for Medicine and the Biological Sciences at UM are based on a mixture of soybean oil, alcohol, water and detergents emulsified into ultra-small particles, smaller than 400 nanometers wide. These are combined with parts or all of the disease-causing microbes to trigger the body's immune response. The smallpox results could lead to an effective human vaccine against smallpox that is safer than the present vaccine because it would use nanoemulsion killed vaccinia virus. In this week's AzoNano interview, Cameron Chai speaks with Andrew Maynard, the Chief Science Advisor for the Project on Emerging Nanotechnologies at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. He learns how they're involved in all aspects of nanoscience and how they look to ensure the safe integration of nanotechnologies, as well as encouraging dialogue between the developers of the science, manufacturers, policymakers, and the public, so that the most educated decisions can be made on the implementation of nanotechnologies.
This is Cameron Chai here from azonano.com, and I'm privileged to have with me today Andrew Maynard, who's the Chief Science Advisor for the Project on Emerging Nanotechnologies from the Woodrow Wilson International Centre for Scholars. How are you doing today, Andrew?
Pretty good, thanks.
And welcome to Australia.
Thank you.
So tell me, Andrew, what does the Project on Emerging Nanotechnologies do, and what does it look to achieve?
We primarily try and help people develop good nanotechnology policies based on the best possible science. So in essence, we're helping people make the best possible decisions on how they're going to develop and use nanotechnologies.
So when you say you're looking to influence decisions, you're talking about even policymakers, the decisions that they make, industry, what directions they go with their technologies and things like that?
Sure. It's everything from policymakers in government trying to develop good policies that are going to underpin good nanotechnologies through to industry that are trying to develop safe and effective technologies, all the way through to the public or different publics and consumers who, if they're faced with a new product which is based on nanotechnology, they want to know how to make a decision on whether to use it or whether not to use it, or even how to use it as safely and effectively as possible. So we cover all the bases in terms of helping people make good decisions.
And you also, sounds like you also cover the technology from go to woe, effectively, from development through to end use.
We really do. And one of the things we try and do is take this life cycle approach to nanotechnologies. So everything from when you first produce or develop the technology through to when you develop it into a product, you use that product, you get rid of it, you dispose of it, even down to recycling it, because there are critical questions in each of those stages.
So you're quite involved with the science behind nanotechnology?
Very much so, yes. And as the science advisor to the project, one of my roles is to make sure that the advice we give and the information we give is as soundly based on science as possible. Because at the end of the day, we really want people to be making decisions that are based on the best possible science.
So you obviously deal with a lot of scientists and researchers and things like that to try and get the science right and get a firm understanding of the science?
We do, yes. And my background is actually in physics, so I spent many years as a researcher and many years in nanotechnology research. But a lot of what we do is trying to understand the science and where the science is going, but also a lot of our focus is on possible risks. The focus is there because, of course, if you're developing a new nanotechnology and there are going to be risks which somebody hasn't spotted at an early stage, you're not going to have a commercially successful product. So we're very interested in trying to work out where those possible risks are, either to human health or the environment, and working a way around those risks so you minimize them. So in terms of the science, a lot of my interest, for instance, is understanding what the science tells us both about those risks and how to avoid those risks.
So when you talk about risk, you also encompasses safety, like in terms of production of nanomaterials, any possible byproducts and things like that during those synthesis?
Sure, it's any aspect of the technology or processes which may lead to harming human health or harming the environment, in essence.
Okay, and then also getting back to development of policy and influencing those sorts of people, you also do a lot of interface with governmental bodies?
We work fairly closely with government, primarily in the US, but we also work with governments around the world. And we work on a number of levels to try and help people make good decisions on the best possible information.
Okay, and talking about the information, you also try to get the information out into the public arena to try and stimulate dialogue between, I guess, the scientists, the developers of the technologies and the possible end users in the public?
We do. One thing that's very clear, I think, these days is that no new technology is going to be effective and be successful if you don't get that dialogue with the end users, so the consumers, the citizens. It's no good to just have good science and good technology. You've also got to have people that believe in that technology and actually understand the benefits to them. So this idea of how people perceive new technology and entering a two-way dialogue with these people that are really going to, at the end of the day, support it is vital to the success of nanotechnologies. So we spend a lot of time both looking at how that works, this dialogue, this engagement, and actually beginning to help people participate in that engagement.
Excellent. All right. And some of the work you do, you obviously work with lots of different groups, whether they be industry and, as we've mentioned, government groups. Can you give us an example of who the sorts of groups that you work with to try and develop these policies? And
yes, let me give you one particular example, which is a good example of the sort of thing we do. And that is an example of use of nanotechnology in the arena of foods, and specifically food packaging. And one of the things that we were interested in is how new and emerging nanotechnologies challenge the regulatory process, whether the use of new nanotechnologies really does require new approaches to regulation, whether existing regulations work effectively. And so we decided to take a particular case study, and the case study we took was the use of engineered nanomaterials in food packaging. And we developed a project where we're working with the US Food and Drug Administration and different food companies within the US. And we brought them both groups to the table to work through a number of hypothetical examples of food packaging products that are using nanotechnology. And we've used these hypotheticals to challenge the regulatory system to see where it would work, how it would work, where there are possibly holes in the system. So this is a collaborative project where we're testing the system and we're helping the government regulatory agency to work through the process, and we're helping industry to work through the process as well, so they can begin to see how things would happen as they actually develop real products and put them into the consumer sphere, I guess.
That's excellent work that you're doing, bringing the governmental bodies and the industry together to try and for a common goal, effectively.
Sure, and there is another aspect of that as well, because we need to look at the broadest possible stakeholder community. We're actually bringing non-government organisations to the table as part of this process as well, so they can bring their own unique perspective to the process of getting something through the regulatory process and ensuring it's as safe as possible.
So what's your opinion on where the regulations and policies are now? Are they keeping pace with the science? Are they adequate at the moment?
Well, it's a huge area of debate, and I don't think anybody would say hand over heart that they're adequate, end of story. I think there are a lot of unknowns and uncertainties there. And we spent a lot of time and asked a number of people to go through the analysis of where things seem to be working, where there seem to be gaps in the regulatory process. It seems where we are at the moment that many of the regulations we have are robust enough to deal with emerging nanotechnologies, or certainly the early generation nanotechnologies, but they've got to be applied in new ways. That the rules that determine how they're applied are going to be different to the rules governing the applications of these regulations to just chemicals. And so we've got to work out how we actually apply these regulations effectively. Having said that, it seems like there are some holes in the system, and there are some gaping holes which are there independent of nanotechnology. So you look at consumer products, for instance. There are really very few regulations in the US which will underpin proactively the introduction of safe consumer products into the consumer marketplace. And that leaves a gaping hole there, irrespective of whether you've got a nanotech product or a non-nanotech product. The problem is, if you're introducing a nanotech-based product into the marketplace, there are chances that it's going to do unanticipated harm that is not only not going to be picked up by the regulatory framework, but also is going to be more serious than maybe some more conventional products out there. And then you've got other regulations in place which have really been developed around the idea of chemicals and how chemicals behave. And though it seems like we may be able to extend those regulations to dealing with engineered nanomaterials, where you've got structure as well as chemistry, which determines their behavior, it's a little bit like bending the current regulations or forcing them into a position where they can be effective with nanomaterials. And it may be at some point we're going to have to rethink how we actually develop regulations which are going to be sensitive to structure as well as chemistry with these materials.
So to some extent, the regulation and policymakers are playing a bit of catch-up still.
If you want to sum all that up in two or three words, yes, I think they are.
All right. And for anybody who's not aware, that you guys on your site for the Project Emerging Nanotechnology, you've got a really good database on nanotechnology in consumer products.
We have, yes. And This is a database we started a couple of years ago simply because nobody could tell us how many products there were out on the marketplace which were based on nanotechnology. So it's a database where we rely entirely on manufacturer-claimed nanotechnology products. So we only put something on there if the manufacturer is claiming to use nanotechnology. And at the moment, we have just shy of 600 products there, and that's growing by the month.
I'm sure there's probably quite a few more out there that maybe people haven't told you about.
We are sure that there are many products out there, either that we haven't discovered yet, or products out there which use nanotechnology where the manufacturer doesn't make a big thing of it, so it's very hard to identify. Mm. Likewise, we're sure that there are many products on the market where the manufacturers claim they're using nanotech and really isn't nanotechnology.
Oh, well. Anyway, I'm sure nanotechnology is going to start infiltrating our lives more and more as time goes on.
I think that's inevitable. And one of the things which really excites me being in this area is you look at what nanotechnology can do, and it's really quite incredible. You look beyond just its ability to revitalize economies towards its ability to really address significant social challenges such as energy production, water purification, targeted drugs. It's just amazing what it could possibly do. But the bottom line is, we're not going to see any of those results if we get things wrong at the first step.
I think that the areas that you mentioned there were the ones actually that were brought up yesterday in the industry forum at the ICON conference where we are now, where a lot of the industry representatives that were on that panel yesterday speaking were identified those particular areas as the ones where nanotechnology was going to have the biggest impact in the, I guess, not too distant future.
Mm-hmm. I think that's very true. To my mind, nanotechnology is just one of a suite of technologies which I think are going to underpin really very significant advances in these areas. But the reality is we've got to get the technology right if we're going to be able to use it wisely and successfully. There are two aspects to this. We've got to understand how to use it wisely, but we've also got to understand where nanotechnology is the best solution and where we've got to combine it with other technologies rather than trying to fix everything with just the one technology.
Well, I think we're all quite aware now that nanotechnology is fairly all-encompassing. It brings together lots of different areas of science that may have operated sort of independently in the past.
I think that's true. And you end up with this strange situation where there is a little bit of rebranding here. You've got science and technology, which have been going on for decades, and nobody ever thought of calling it nanotechnology. And, of course, now nanotech is the big thing. It's being rebranded. But even when you strip that away, there is tremendous innovation going on under this umbrella of being able to manipulate things at the nanoscale to do new things. And that's where things get very exciting.
All right, Andrew. Thanks very much for all your insight into nanotechnology. And like I said, if anybody's interested in where nanotechnology has been used in consumer items, they should log on to your website. And again, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks very much, Colin.
Azo Nano Business News. Arrowhead Research Corporation announced a fundamental streamlining of its majority-owned subsidiaries, Calando Pharmaceuticals and Insert Therapeutics. Arrowhead will assume active management of the companies and focus resources on bringing multiple products to the clinic as rapidly as possible. Arrowhead's expanded role is intended to make Calando and Insert operations more efficient. This is a process that includes a merger of the companies, which has been submitted to shareholders. NanoTerra, a privately held company focused on the commercialization of industrial applications of surface chemistry, announced two technology collaboration agreements with Nestrec Limited. Under the terms of the agreement, the companies will work together to use new technologies to develop and bring to market advanced next-generation PET product packaging solutions and manufacturing processes. Agar Scientific is pleased to announce that they have been appointed distributors for OmniProbe consumables and accessories. OmniProbe have been notable for their innovation in creating new solutions for FIB and SEM analysis. This range of consumables is specifically tailored to the production of high-quality TEM sample preparation inside the FIB. The accessory range includes sample holders, grid and sample holders combined, and probe tip holders. Consumables include simple half-ring grids as well as 4 or 5-post custom copper lift-out grids specifically designed for in-situ lift-out. These grids, also available in molybdenum, incorporate multiple indexed mounting locations, all with vertical bar attachment surfaces. SUS Microtech, a leading supplier of precision manufacturing and test equipment for the semiconductor and related markets, has appointed Thomas Bresser to the position of Vice President of Sales. Thomas Bresser comes to SUS with almost 20 years international experience within the semiconductor industry. He's held positions in general management, sales management, business development, product planning and strategic marketing. MEMS software provider Conventor Incorporated, along with the Micro and Nanotechnology Commercialization Education Foundation, will award 4 one-year licenses for Conventor's Conventorware Designer Analyzer package to students during the COMS 2008 conference. The scholarships are granted based on proposals submitted by students working in microsystems research around the world. Nanovations Proprietary Limited has entered an agreement with the German high-tech company Holmenkoll for distribution and collaborative product development. The main objective of the partnership is the promotion and the development of new innovative coating solutions for new markets. Holmenkoll has received the worldwide exclusive rights to distribute all sport-relevant products and developments. A new framework for the development of Victoria's nanotechnology sector was released today by the Innovation Minister, Gavin Jennings. Speaking at the opening of the 2008 International Conference in Nanoscience and Nanotechnology in Melbourne, Mr. Jennings said nanotechnology would be a key transforming factor for industry and society in this century. That was Azo Nano News for the week commencing the 25th of February 2008. If you have any nano courses, events or exhibitions you'd like to promote to a global nanotech audience, don't forget you can list them for free at azonano.com. To review any of the stories you've heard about in this podcast or to stay in touch with the world of nanotechnology, please visit www.azonano.com. If you'd like to send us feedback or let us know about nanotechnology news in your part of the world, please email us at podcast@azonano.com. I'm Stuart Cameron. Thanks for listening.